From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. These days, there are different ways to encounter a book. You can listen to it, you can see it on a screen. The writer Anthony Doerr likes a book, the paper kind. He compares reading to walking a trail. He says he likes to see where he's going and where he's been. So, as he once said, the actual weight of the pages he's turned give him a sense of how far he's come. Doerr's new novel is on the list of books we're talking about today. It's our annual summer reading program, and by now you know the drill. We have our group of experts with us to try and get through as many titles for you to consider this season as we can in about an hour. So now would be a good time to grab that pen. We're back right after the news.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. Our online audio and podcasts are made possible by KUER and its listeners. If you like Radio West, help us make it happen. You can donate $10 right now by texting KUER to 85944. That's KUER to 85944. And thanks.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Like it or not, the internet is changing the experience of reading, of books. The trade magazine Publishers Weekly says among the trends we're seeing in this digital age is the emergence of visual literature. That's animated stuff with moving graphics and crowdsourced publishing and social media marketing. There's even something called data-driven narratives, which is basically a computer which is doing the writing. But, and this is a pretty big but, the magazine says there are certain stubborn concepts that have so far retained their shape, like the integrity of a story with a beginning and middle and an end, like the book as a container of ideas, and like the necessary involvement of writers, imagine that, and editors and publishers and, for our purposes today, places where you go to buy books. Today in the program, we've reconvened our little three-person panel of booksellers to give you ideas, titles for the summer reading season. So find something to write with because we are going to get started. Ken Sanders is back with us, owner of Ken Sanders Rare Books in downtown Salt Lake City. Ken, welcome back.
Always a pleasure, Doug.
Betsy Burton is with us. She owns the King's English Bookshop at 15th and 15th in Salt Lake. Welcome back to you.
Thanks, Doug.
And Catherine Weller back with us, the new book buyer for the Weller Bookworks bookstore at Trolley Square in Salt Lake City. And Kat, welcome back to you.
Thank you, Doug.
Well, I always start. I don't want to spend too much time with this because we have all we never get to as many book titles as I hope we will. But I do like checking in with sort of the trends, the things that you're seeing so far. Has it been a good year so far for books?
I have some great news. Our business is way up, and I attribute it to Amazon.
Really?
Yes, because they have been so completely nasty trying to subjugate the publishers, particularly Hachette, that they have made a lot of customers very angry, and they come in saying, I'm here to buy my books now. I'm done with Amazon. It's great news all around.
What do you think?
They announced at the National New Book Convention that Betsy and I just went to that for the first time in several years, the new bookstores in America have opened at such a rate that we're exceeding 2,000 now, which is a wonderful thing. For years, we were dropping and dropping, and for several years new bookstores have been coming on the upswing.
Wow.
Bookstore owners who want to retire can actually sell rather than close their shops. It's good. There's a sea change in the air for bookselling.
The reign of Damazon's terror is waning.
Thank you, Ken.
Well, tell me about the actual content inside the books that you're seeing. Has it been a good year for that, for writing, you know?
The fiction this year is so much better than it was last fall. These are some of the best books I've seen in years. They're fabulous.
Astonishingly good fiction, really powerful nonfiction. The spring and summer are great. Fall is going to be dynamite in some areas. Huh. So, yeah, it's a good year for bookselling.
Yeah. Utah and Western books, it's been an absolutely fascinating year for great nonfiction, Western and Mormon Utah narratives, and great poetry coming out by Utah poets.
Mm-hmm. Which we'll get to, I guess. I'm guessing you'll get to it, right?
Yes.
Because you always do.
I try to.
Well, why don't you start? Ken Sanders.
Okay, continuing the theme of Utah and Western books, we've got a new signature books out called Lost Apostles by William Shepherd and Michael Marquardt. It deals with the early days of the LDS Church and the formation of the first 12 apostles, all appointed by Joseph Smith in the 1830s, and tells their stories and lives. Of the 12 original LDS Church apostles, Doug, only six of them, even though some left and came back to the church, at the end of the day and at the end of their lives, only six of the original 12 apostles stayed within the LDS faith. And up until recently, official church records and that, not that they demonized them, but just the apostles that left were just kind of left out of church history. And this book, for the first time, tells the full story of all 12 of the original apostles of the church, and I think it's a very important history of Mormon and LDS history.
Hmm. So this is Lost Apostles, Forgotten Members of Mormonism's Original Quorum of the 12. That's William Shepherd and Michael Marquardt.
A fine new book by Signature Books. Our perennial historian, Will Bagley, I know you had Will on with this very book, his new book, South Pass, Gateway to a Continent. South Pass, I mean, as you well know, it was the easiest way to get over the Continental Divide, to cross the Shining Mountains, the Rocky Mountains. And tens or hundreds of thousands of people, whether they were Argonauts or the Goldfielders or the Mormons or whomever, for whatever reasons, from important things like the Pony Express to the telegraph line, this made it possible to cross from the known continent to the wild frontier in a single season, which if they hadn't have discovered South Pass, that could have been – it could have years, decades before the interior of the West would have ever been
changed
settled.
Everything. Seems.
Up until the Transcontinental Railroad.
Absolutely.
And last,
so that's South Pass.
Will Bagley. And the third one I want to mention is local attorney and Sherlock Holmes aficionado Michael Homer has written the definitive history of Mormonism and Freemasonry, which has been almost 200-year-old debate between Mormons and Masons, and how much the LDS temple's rituals copied early Masonic temple rituals, and back from the era when Mormons and Masons were openly hostile with one another, that lasted through probably the mid-20th century to a much more new openness between the two groups now. It's called Joseph's Temples, The Dynamic Relationship Between Freemasonry and Mormonism by Michael W. Homer. It's probably the definitive work on a subject that's a very keen interest here locally and nationally.
Great. Ken, thanks. Betsy.
Well, I'm starting with fiction like I always do, and I'm starting with what is so far and probably for the whole year my favorite book of the year, All the Light We Cannot See by Anthony Doerr. It's just an extraordinary novel. I have a hard time not crying when I talk about it.
Really?
It's so good. Oh, I love it. It's about two young people. One is a blind girl who's the child of someone who works at the Museum of Natural History in Paris. He's a locksmith, among other things. Another is an orphan boy in Germany. And they are connected by the voice of a radio that broadcasts later in the book. But at the beginning, you don't see the connection. It's in alternating chapters between the two children as they grow, as the war closes in on them. And so you see the war in both France and Germany. You see these two children. The girl and her father have to flee Paris and end up in Saint-Malo. And her father leaves her alone, but he has taught her to see in a way that you have to read the book to find out. And the boy ends up in a Hitler youth academy, one of the cruelest places I've ever read about anywhere, and then as an agent. But the voice he's heard and the things he sees teach him to see. They both, everybody I think in the book in one way or another, learns to see. But the story, because the father and daughter have taken something with them as they flood the museum in Paris. The story, in a way, reads like a thriller. It's very complicated, but all the pieces fit together as if it were some sort of a mystery, and yet it works on a very high level. And because there are elements almost of fairy tale in it, it works on a mythic level. It's just an extraordinary novel. I cried several times while I was reading it. I read it the first time 6 months ago, and it's haunted me ever since. It's extraordinary.
I should just mention he's on the show tomorrow.
Oh.
Live in studio. He's in town for a reading, and he lives in Boise.
He does live in Boise, and he'll be at our store, too.
Lovely guy. Yeah. Terrific.
Okay.
Oh, say it again. Just
All the Light We Cannot See by Anthony Doerr. Another extraordinary novel that takes place during the same time period and couldn't possibly be more different is Francine Prose's Lovers at the Chameleon Club, Paris, 1932. It takes place at a Parisian nightclub that's very much in the line of the Berlin nightclubs leading up to the war, a place where if you're transgender or gay or different in any way at all, everybody's accepted and they're all having fun together until the war comes and the Nazis close in. And the main characters are a photographer and a writer, and Lou Villar, who is the villain of the piece. And she starts out as a world-class athlete, becomes a race car driver, and then becomes a Nazi villain. This is a book where you don't love the characters, but you're totally fascinated by them. It's social satire. It's great fun to read, and she's a brilliant writer.
That's Francine Prose, Lovers at the Chameleon Club,
Paris.
Paris, 1932.
And then the third pick for my first Round of Fiction is The Painter by Peter Heller. If ever there were a great Father's Day present, this is it. It's about a man. It's really a quintessential Western in a way. It's about a man who flees Santa Fe. He's an artist, and he flees because of violence, the violence he's committed. He's committed to not being like this anymore. He's in Colorado. He really is serious about his art. He falls in love with a woman. Driving along, he sees a man brutalizing a horse. Violence comes back. He ends up back in Santa Fe. It's a real page-turner, but it's really about the connection of violence, creativity, and love, and it's just fascinating. A great read. The Painter by Peter Heller.
Great. Catherine Weller.
Well, I think a great book for Father's Day is Carsick by John Waters. This book is a memoir of a trip that John Waters decided to make across the country.
Explain who John. I'm sure
okay,
most people
I'm
know.
Okay, I'm sorry.
But,
yes,
yeah.
John Waters is a cult filmmaker. He is known to those of us of a certain age for films we saw down in the Blue Mouse.
Right.
That,
the grimy parts of Baltimore.
We really can't talk about on the radio about the grimy part of Baltimore. And then he turned to a more refined filmmaker as he grew. He was the guy who directed Hairspray, for instance, which is a whole different animal from Pink Flamingos. But he's also a pop culture icon and a film icon. So when he decided to hit the road hitchhiking to write a book, of course it turned into a project that eventually became this book, and who knows, it may eventually become a film. In the beginning of the book, he sits down and he imagines all of the good things that could happen on this trip and all of the really terrible things that could happen on this trip. And there's a wonderful scene where he's imagining being picked up by somebody who hates cult films, who hates what he does in particular. And we've got a clip of that.
Just repeat after me, I plead. It's only a movie. It's only a movie. It's only a movie. But this old catchline from an exploitation ad campaign doesn't do the trick. And that birth scene in Female Trouble he charges like an obscenity prosecutor was absolutely disgusting. Before I can even plead my defense, he shoots me in the other leg. I howl in agony. I scream for my life. We pull into the Las Vegas city limits. Time flies when you're being tortured. I see the ridiculous skyline of the town, a place filled with tourists I have spent my lifetime trying to avoid. Look, Randy, I groan through spasms of pain. Just let me out here. I promise I won't make any trash films again. I'll go make mainstream movies, I swear. It's too late for a career change, Randy snarls with murderous rage as he pulls his truck off the road into an abandoned drive-in movie theater. It's been a long time since any movies were shown here. There's not even a screen anymore, and the concession stand has been burned to the ground. The few remaining poles for the speakers have been stripped clean of working parts. Randy slams on his brakes with a sickening finality. "Get in the back," Randy orders. "No, Randy, please," I argue. "Let's go see the Avengers. Let's go see Hollywood tentpole blockbusters." His answer? A bullet into my right foot.
Who knew? He can write.
Yeah, he can. Of course, all of his fantasies are rather like John Waters movies.
Totally, absolutely.
But the book itself is more than a John Waters movie. It's a wonderful travelogue. It's a journey across America with indie bands, with people who pick him up who know who he is, who don't know who he is. It's a fantastic, lovely summer read.
Carsick.
John Waters.
John Waters, absolutely. Well, I guess we should take a break here and get back in a moment. That's Catherine Weller from Weller Book Works at Trolley Square. We have Betsy Burton with us also from the King's English Bookshop on 15th and 15th here in Salt Lake City. And Ken Sanders is with us. Of course, he owns Ken Sanders Rare Books on 2nd East in Salt Lake City. And we'll take a break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, presenting our annual summer reading program, we have our local booksellers, book experts, Ken Sanders, Catherine Weller, Betsy Burton with us. And by the way, I should mention that all of the books, even the ones we don't get to, we will put on a list, and you can access it on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. Okay, Catherine Weller. We're talking about kids' books,
I should say,
right?
Yeah. Yes, yes. And I am starting with a kids' book by a local cartoonist and now author, Mark Pett. This book is called The Girl and the Bicycle. It follows up last year's lovely book, The Boy in the Airplane. Mark does a wonderful job of doing wordless books that are monochromatic, except for little pieces of color within there, but tell very poignant stories. This is the story about a girl who sees a bike she wants. She saves up for it. She does all this work, and she goes to the store window to get it, and it's gone. She gives her tricycle to her little brother and tries to find joy in that, and then something happens that brings it all home for her and makes it worthwhile. Mark is a very sentimental children's book illustrator, and these are books that are great for grandparents or really weepy parents like me. It's just adorable. And I love wordless books because it really allows a child to help tell the story. Mm. So that's quite nice.
Say the title.
Girl and the Bicycle, yep, by Mark Pett.
Yeah.
Next, I have another wordless book, Otto in the City by Tom Shamp. And this is a great book for road trips. Well, it's not totally wordless, but its use on road trips is wordless. What this is an oversized book with very stiff cardboard pages that tell the journey of a guy on a road trip going through the city. And what you've got is the road on the page that's the perfect size for a little, say, matchbox car. And so you can put a kid in the back seat with this book, taking the journey while you're taking a long journey, or at night. And it's kind of a nice, quiet way to settle down. And when he reaches the end, it gets flipped over, and he goes back the other way again.
Wow.
It's really clever. It's bright. It's eye-catching. And it's interactive in such a low-tech but perfect way.
Yeah. Yeah.
So Otto in the City by Tom Shamp. The last one is a fairly wordy book, although for a young adult novel, it's not really bulky. It's called We Were Liars by E. Lockhart. It's been getting a lot of buzz because it's well written. It is about a family in New England that's very, very privileged, think Kennedys, who spends their whole summers on islands. She has this great description of them. Our smiles are wide, our chins square, and our tennis serves aggressive. The Liars are three kids who grow up together, the progeny of the daughters of the patriarch of the family. Everybody gets together to manipulate one another about money. A fourth character comes in, an outsider, and the kids bond together, have really fun, interesting adventures that only the wealthy do, and it all goes to hell. And it goes to hell slowly in the way that happens when people are manipulative with no real lives and no real grounding out of money. And it goes to hell in a very shocking way in the end that really, I knew there was a twist in here, but it surprised me. Huh. The novel's a little more gothic than it appears at the beginning.
Gosh.
So, We
what
Were Liars by E. Lockhart. It's marketed as a young adult novel, which is a sweeping age group of about 12 to 17, right?
Yeah.
This could easily be read by a 12-year-old, but I think it's going to be more appreciated by somebody in, say, the 14 to 16 range.
Got it.
Although, you know, adults read young adult novels all the time, and they love them. And half the people that are talking about this are 20-somethings.
The grown-ups. Good.
Yep.
We Were Liars, E. Lockhart. Great. Let's see. Ken, over to you.
Well, Doug, I've just returned from a trip to California doing an antiques roadshow and visiting the children and the grandchildren. So that's always a good time to catch up on children's books with Flynn and Lyra. So Flynn's latest is there's, as any parent or grandparent of preschoolers would know, there's a very popular video called Thomas the Train. And I happened to take Flynn a Thomas the Train books. And there's a whole series of them, of course. They're in the, you know, the beginner reader. I can read Dr. Seuss series that have gone, of course, far beyond Dr. Seuss over the years. This particular opus is called Go, Train, Go. And it involves Thomas the Train, of course, picking up the lady judge and, despite a lot of obstacles, taking her to the train judging competition. And, you know, spoiler alert here, Thomas wins the competition.
Oh, no.
There was no bribery involved. So Flynn, I have a conversation with him, and I say, well, Flynn, why don't you read the book to me tonight? He says, Grandpa, I can't read. And I said, well, you know, I kind of think you can because you know all the letters, you know all the words, you can. So he starts out by reading Go Train Go. And before I knew it, he sat there and read. He's 4 years old and he read the entire book to me. And one time when he was kind of losing interest and goofing off, I attempted to read a page. Grandpa, no, I'm reading the book. You're not supposed to read it. And what's great about this whole early reader, beginner reader, I can read series is they're not boring and as simplistic as the old Dick and Jane books. They're really clever, interesting plots, and they subtly introduce new words like the word judge that was completely unfamiliar to Flynn, but also repeating words over and over, like train he has no problem with at all. And he actually read the whole book. So I can't recommend this series enough to get your preschoolers interested and invested in reading. The one other one I want to mention, and I know I've talked about the Oz books before, but in this great annotated series, they had annotated Mother Goose way back when, Alice in Wonderland, a whole great series. We now have the annotated Wizard of Oz, and it's just the compendium of everything Oz. It has wonderful end sheets of the different colored lands of Oz. It's got artwork and photographs from the photo play, from the stage play, from the very famous movie. And the one thing I want to underscore with, you know, long before Harry Potter or the Chronicles of Narnia or The Hobbit or The Lord of the Rings or all these mega-selling, you know, fantasy series for kids, and they're all wonderful. I like them all. But long before any of these, there was L. Frank Baum and his longtime illustrator, John Arneil. 40 Oz books from 1899 to 1939. Baum, before he died, wrote the first 14. Ruth Plumly Thompson took over, wrote the next 20 books, all illustrated, other than The Wizard, by John Arneil. John Arneil then took the series over and wrote and illustrated 3. Then there were a handful of others. The Land of Oz, The Marvelous Land of Oz, as one of the books is called, is so much more than just the movie, as good as the movie is. There are so many. Bettina, the talking hen, the scallywagons, the sawhorse, Tick-Tock of Oz, the mechanical man. There are hundreds of brilliant conceived characters, and these are just fun. I hate to use the word wholesome, but they're just wholesome, delightful books that aren't going to offend anybody for any reason, and they're just really great, fun books to read.
Great. Betsy Burton.
Okay, I'm going to start with a chapter book for middle readers, so 8 to 12. It is a mystery, and I think in the summertime, what better way to spend your time than reading mysteries? I read Nancy Drew pretty much constantly when I was that age. It's by Laura Marks Fitzgerald. It's called Under the Egg. And at the beginning, a young girl's grandfather has died. They live in a very expensive group of row houses in New York, but theirs is very run down. They haven't fixed it up in at least 50 years. And the way they exist is to keep chickens and a garden up on the roof. They are very poor, and the grandfather has died, and they've been subsisting on his income. So now she has $400 to live on for however long, and then who knows what's going to happen. Her grandfather has a painting on the mantle with a white egg, and she takes the painting down, and it turns out to be an overpainting, and under it there is a painting by a very famous artist, and she knows that, but she's not sure who. She knows a fair amount about art from her grandfather. He's a modernist. And so she begins to investigate. She goes to the museum. She goes to the library. So this gives a child of that age a real grounding in art history.
Okay. But
fascinating and mysterious. She meets a young woman who lives in one of the expensive and fixed-up houses next door, and the two of them investigate, and it turns out, this is a spoiler alert, but presumably the children aren't listening,
yeah,
a painting by Raphael.
Wow.
And so it is a bit of a mystery. There are some villains, but they're pretty lightweight. It's a fascinating story about investigating a painting for children, just getting how exciting it can be.
It's great.
It's just a great read. I stayed up all night reading it, actually. It's called Under the Egg, and it's for 8 to 12-year-olds. Another story about a grandfather who's died, this by a writer from Las Vegas. We consider her really almost local. It's called The Chapel Wars. And the young woman in this is left the wedding chapel by her grandfather when he dies, and she's only 16. She understands business, but she's only 16. Now, this chapel really is up to the good, dignified kind of weddings. They do everything right. It's beautiful. It's not tacky at all. Next door, there's a ticky-tacky chapel, and it's run by the arch rival of her grandfather, this guy, a very small character, and they have drive-by weddings, probably drive-by shootings. It's just a terrible place. So the young woman is quite attracted, though, to the grandson of the ticky-tacky place. His name is Dax, and he is very handsome indeed. So in a way, this is a Romeo and Juliet love story. It's a little bit like the Montagues and the Capulets, only set in Las Vegas. It's funny. It's got a good, quick, assured voice, a nice little romance, and a good summer read.
Great. The Chapel Wars.
The Chapel Wars by Lindsay Levitt. So then my favorite kids' book of the summer, Naked. It's a picture book. It says for 4 to 8, but I think one-year-olds would love that.
Yeah.
So it's about a little boy who obviously takes a great deal of joy in being naked. And it begins when he hops out of the bathtub and thinks, "Ooh, this is fun." Woo! And he runs away from his mother and down the stairs, his mother in mad pursuit, saying, "Naked, naked, naked," and just having the best time of his life, begins to imagine what it would be like to be naked in school and on the playground. And he says, "I don't need shirts. I don't need pants. I don't need capes." "Oh, capes," he says. "Cape!" And he starts charging around in a cape, naked underneath the cape, of course. Then he gets cold and tired and sleepy, and like any perfect bedtime story, goes to bed. It's called Naked, and anybody from one on would love this book.
Great. Okay, back to the grown-up stuff. Catherine Weller.
Nonfiction this time. I'll start with The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History by Elizabeth Culbert. Elizabeth Culbert is the author of the marvelous Field Notes from a Catastrophe. She is a terrific science writer, great
The New Yorker.
Natural history writer for The New Yorker. This book is about the collision of civilization and the ecosystem. It covers the Andes, the Amazonian rainforest, Great Barrier Reef, and our own backyard.
Yeah.
All of it. The title comes from what the biologists are now calling the sixth mass extinction. That's now. And they're estimating that 20 to 50% of all of the plant animal species that are in existence now will be threatened or gone within the end of this century. This is really good scientific analysis interspersed with personal narratives. She's a compelling writer, and it's kind of depressing, but it's an important book, and it's a good book, and it's very well done. She has this wonderful line within the text: "Right now, we are deciding without quite meaning to which evolutionary pathways will remain open and which will be forever closed," which is poignant in a way you wouldn't expect to get in a science book.
Yeah, so, she's terrific.
Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History by Elizabeth Colbert. Next is Bad Luck Way, A Year on the Ragged Edge of the West by Bryce Andrews. This actually came out right at the very end of December and kind of was one of those bridge books through the middle season. Bryce was a young man who left Spokane to work on a ranch in Montana in the Centennial Valley, or close to the Centennial Valley. It's an ecologically managed ranch. This is the story of him coming in to learn how to work the ranch, protect the ranch and what's on the ranch, at the same time that a pack of wolves, of Montana wolves, comes down into the valley as well. He's a naturalist. He has a naturalist's eye, so he writes lovingly about the land, lovingly about the wolf, and the wolves, and tragically about when all of them finally intersect, because he really believed it was his job to protect all parties involved, and that couldn't necessarily happen in here. This is a memoir. It's very well done. It is a terrific book of place, of the modern West, of all that we grapple with out here right now. Mm-hmm. It's called Bad Luck Way by Bryce Andrews. Last is another, it's not as heavy as it seems, Plato at the Googleplex, Why Philosophy Won't Go Away by Rebecca Goldstein. She is a novelist and a philosopher, and it's interesting discussing with people what she does best, whether she philosophizes or novelizes best.
Right.
This book imagines what would happen were Plato to come to America right now in the modern world and how he would interact with it. So it's a structure that goes with Plato starting with an address in Google, the Google headquarters in Menlo, California, I believe, and interacting with people there who want to crowdsource ethical decisions. And then she talks about moral philosophy and Plato for a while. And then we follow Plato to the 92nd Street Y, where he has a debate with two parenting experts, Freudian and somebody who is like Amy Chua. The tiger mother.
Yeah.
And then he talks with a bloviator on cable TV. All the while, she is also writing these chapters that really, really incisively pin down why we do need philosophy today, why philosophy is relevant for every single generation.
But it's not too dense or pedantic or anything like
that? It's not too dense or pedantic. She gets into wonderful things about why people... why morality can exist outside of religion, why living a meaningful life is leading a moral life and what that means, the great questions of philosophy that we always grapple with. Mm. It's a fun read. So, Plato at the Googleplex by Rebecca Goldstein.
Terrific. Ken Sanders.
Google is in, HQ is in Mountain View, by the way, Kat.
Oh, but I got it wrong.
My son works there, so I happen to know that. They have a lot of campuses.
They do.
Okay, so back to regional books. First, we have the first history of Bates Wilson, The Heart of Canyonlands. It's called, I have to question this title, Blow Sand in His Soul. You have to be very careful how you say that. Could have had a better title, but it's a great book. Bates Wilson is widely known as the father of Canyonlands. I think it's fair to say that Arches and Canyonlands, Arches was made a national park the same year in 64 as Canyonlands was created. It tells all the stories of the great characters there, including one Edward Abbey, who was Arches National Monument Ranger back in the 1950s. There's one quick story I'll tell about Bates. It's my favorite from all my years in Canyonlands and Arches. Bates discovered an arch in the fiery furnace, and the Moab Times Independent dutifully reported the discovery of this new arch, and they said that Superintendent Wilson had made this fabulous discovery, this magnificent arch in the fiery furnace, which was then a very remote backcountry part of the park. And the way they recounted the story is that Bates looked up suddenly and saw an arch, and they quote him as saying, "Oh my gosh, what a surprise. It's an arch." And they named it Surprise Arch. Well, anybody that knew Bates Wilson knew, Bates didn't exactly talk like that. And what he really said was, "Oh my God, it's an arch." And so the locals always have referred to it as "Oh my God, arch." But today on the maps, it's listed as Surprise Arch. And it's a beautiful arch.
Say the name of the book again, even though you don't like the title.
Blow Sand in His Soul. Bates Wilson, The Heart of Canyonlands.
Right.
Could just be me, but...
No, it's not just you.
Katie Lee, as you all know, you may not know, she's 94 years old now. She called me up about a year ago, pretty depressed and in her own colorful way, bad-mouthing various presses around for taking too bloody long. I'll try to edit her language here, to publish her book. And at 94, she had some concerns about publishing her final work before she dies. And, at 94, it's a legitimate concern.
Yep.
So I said, "Katie, look, you know, my little publishing company, Dream Garden Press, I'll do it for you, but you can't get mad at me if I don't sell any copies. I'll get the book out. I can't promise you anything else. This is what I can do. I'll get your book out. I want to get your book out." And I managed to talk her into using this nude photograph of her in Glen Canyon in the 50s on the cover. So
pretty provocative cover.
The Ghosts of Dandy Crossing, it's her love story, her novel of her lifelong love affair. Dandy Crossing, of course, was a dandy place to cross the Colorado at height, Utah, and her lifetime love affair of Glen Canyon. And lastly, totally switching subjects, and I know you had Nick on when On Paper, Nicholas Bazbane's The Everything of Its 2,000-Year History. His first book was Gentle Madness. I think this is his best book since Gentle Madness. It's really terrific. On Paper, Nicholas Bazbane's.
Great. And Betsy Burton, back to you.
Okay, I'm going to talk about a novel that I love called The Plover by Brian Doyle, who some of you may know from Mink River. He's a wonderful writer. And as this book opens, Declan, who is really a loner, wants to be more alone than ever. He is rigged out a rusty old fishing boat, and he's taking off into the ocean by himself, wanting to disprove John Donne and be a man who is an island. And as fate would have it, he picks up first an old friend, kind of by accident, and his disabled daughter, an enchanting child that is a big part of this book. But he picks up his old friend and then another person and another person from this Russian fishing trawler. So the head of this Russian fishing, the captain of this fishing trawler, is really an Ahab character. His name is Enrique, and the fishing trawler is called The Tenants. So Enrique really is Captain Ahab, and the rest of the crew is sort of like three men on a boat. So it's hard to see how he could possibly combine these characters, but he does it actually brilliantly. So the boat, as it fills up, is bobbing along and becoming more and more of a family. The people are kind of uniting and arguing and doing the things that families do as they have adventures in the ocean. Meanwhile, they are stalked by Enrique and the tenant. And where we are, when there is a quote coming up here, and where we are, they know he's getting closer. And their motor is cut out twice, and now they're becalmed. The wind has stopped. It's dusk. They think they might just make it to darkness. Under the cloak of darkness, they might get away.
On the Tenants, all Enrique could see was the red sail and the blue water and the dwindling daylight. Everything else was outside the narrow cone of his vision. "I see you," he said aloud. "I see you. You cannot hide. The night will do nothing for you. I know where you are.
I know where you are going. You stole from me. You took what was mine. This cannot abide. One theft leads to 10, and then where are we? Adrift. Disorder disrupts order. I give the orders. I command both our boats. I command you to flee. I command fear. Having committed disorder, you have brought disorder upon you. It is the law. I command that you will be caught 1 hour after full darkness, and your boat destroyed, and my property returned, and no evidence of your existence or destruction will be found evermore. What you were will sink to the bottom of the sea and be lost, and none will remember or testify. But with a real start of surprise, he heard himself talking aloud in a loud, cold voice, and some deep part of him was frightened. He sat down and put his face in his hands, and was startled at the shocking heat of his skin and a slather of sweat so heavy his hands glistened. Am I sick? Is this a bad illness?
It's Dr. David Drummond reading The Plover by Brian Doyle. Betsy Burton, it's one of her suggestions. She joins us from the King's English Bookshop at 15th and 15th. Catherine Weller from the Weller Bookworks at Trolley Square, and Ken Sanders from Ken Sanders Rare Books on 2nd East in Salt Lake City. A list of all of these books, even the ones we don't get to, are going to be on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, it's our annual summer reading show, so we've gathered our panel of experts today from some of Utah's local bookstores to offer some suggestions for the summer's reading season. And it's always a long list. The stuff we get to and even the stuff we don't, we'll have on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. Okay, round four. Betsy, back at it.
Okay, I'm going to start with nonfiction, with kind of an unusual piece of nonfiction, Roz Chast, Can't We Talk About Something More Pleasant, a memoir, but it's a memoir in cartoons. Yeah. She's a New Yorker cartoonist, really kind of like a graphic novel, memorabilia, photographs, you name it. Everything is in this. And as I mentioned, Peter Heller being a Father's Day present, this is definitely not a Mother's Day present, particularly not for elderly mothers, because it is the memoir of a daughter trying to care for her elderly mother, who is the most annoying elderly mother any of you have ever met. At least I hope so. And she knows everything. She is a saver. She saves everything. She doesn't listen to anybody. She needs to tell everybody how to do everything. And the trick here that our poor Roz Chast is trying to learn is how to keep your patience. Hang on to your patience. Don't laugh. Don't cry. And be kind. And she doesn't usually succeed in this endeavor.
Yeah.
It's hysterically funny 1 minute, and then you catch a sob the next because it's so moving. This poor woman trying to act like a human being who really doesn't know how, and it's getting worse with every passing year. I love this book. And as I said, don't give it to your 90-year-old mother, but you might give it to your 40-year-old mother who's having to mother her 90-year-old mother.
Yeah. Say the name again.
Can't We Talk About Something More Pleasant, Roz Chast.
Yeah.
Then the next book I couldn't bring because it's not out yet, but it will be out in time for the 4th of July. It's a perfect 4th of July book. It's called Liberty's Torch by Elizabeth Mitchell. And Liberty's Torch is about the building, the erecting of the Statue of Liberty, which sounds actually like kind of a boring book, but it's hysterically funny.
It
is funny because this guy who brought all this about was a con man of the First Order. He was French, and he was a sculptor, but he had in mind originally an Egyptian sculpture of a massive sort. And when he couldn't sell that, he was part of the Alliance Française Americaine, and so he started using the French and the Americans against each other to raise money to erect the statue he wanted. So first of all, he got some money from the French, and then he parlayed that into some money in the U.S. for the base, and then for an island to put the statue on and so forth, back and forth. There's a wonderful cast of characters, including Eiffel, because, you know, when you build a sculpture of this size, it's not all about art. Most of it's engineering. And Victor Hugo and Joseph Pulitzer, and he's manipulating everybody on both continents. His name is Bertoldi, and he is a truly memorable figure of history. So you will learn a lesson in American history that you have never guessed before. It's called Liberty's Torch. It's Elizabeth Mitchell.
Great.
And then my last book is local, Gaza Gaza Girl Goes to Camp. It's by Lily Nakai Havy, and she was in – they lived in Hollywood, in a poor area of Hollywood, but they had a fairly happy family, two kids and the mother and father. And then as soon as Pearl Harbor came, everybody was interned. Yeah. She was sent first to Santa Anita to the racetrack, where she actually thought she was going on a camping trip. And she quickly found out that that was not right. And there are wonderful, wonderful watercolors here. Here is one of her supposed camping trip. They're wonderful watercolors. She is a wonderful artist. And so this is the tale. They end up in Colorado. And this is a tale that works. She's got a great voice, plucky, mischievous young woman who tells, young girl, who tells the truth. I mean, she doesn't hide. And a troubled relationship between her parents, the history of her grandparents told by her mother, the paintings and historical photographs, which wrap this whole tale and give it just so many dimensions. This is just an amazing book. I you know, started reading it thinking I would be interested, but I was just overwhelmed. Mm. It's just a fascinating tale on all levels. And although I knew about the Japanese internships, I knew the basic story, the details in this book really blew me away, and I didn't expect her voice to be so good. There's another painting. It's just a remarkable book. It's Gaza Gaza Girl Goes to Camp, a Nisei Youth Behind a World War II Fence, and I can't recommend it highly
Say the name
enough.
Of the author again.
Lily Yuriko Nakai Havy.
Havy. You may recognize that name. That's this Michael. Is Michael Havy, our operations director's mom. He's proud of that, too, I'm sure.
He should be.
Kat.
All right, fiction for me. First is Shotgun Love Songs by Nicholas Butler. This was another one that came out earlier in the season. It's a novel set in the Midwest, very strong sense of place, about four men in their 30s who have reached a time in their lives when they are coming together for a wedding, and they're looking at how they got where they are, where they want to be, and the kinds of men they want to be. It's a beautifully done book. It's one of those books that explores very different people who follow different things. One of them is a musician who does very well, who is modeled on the lead singer of Bon Iver because Nick grew up with this man. So this is, it has a little bit of real-life application to it, too. Yeah, I thought that would get you. a man who's a rodeo rider, a man who settled on his dad's farm and is farming. And he's the most interesting one. He's kind of the narrator. And he is the man who shows us throughout this book that settling down isn't necessarily settling. It's a beautiful book. It's called Shotgun Love Songs by Nicholas Butler. Mm. Next one is Us Conductors. It's a paperback original from Sean Michaels from a small press named Tin House. This is about Theremin, Lev Theremin, the man who made the theremin, the instrument. It starts with him being locked in a ship's hold, and he's writing the story of how he is locked in this hold with his equipment across the hall from him, sailing back presumably to Russia after a great period of spying and love and exploration and invention and in America. What he loved was physics, and especially the physics of sound. And it's written about very lovingly in this book. It is, the prose in this is really nice.
Really?
It's a good book, yeah. Shawn Michaels, there were passages in here that I had to go back and reread because they were just, they're spare, but they're lovely. Last one.
Us Conductors.
Us Conductors, Shawn Michaels. Last one is a romp. It's called The Weirdness by Jeremy Bushnell. This opens with a man waking up hungover, alone, he thinks, in his apartment, but he smells coffee. He goes down his loft. He's in New York, so it's a tiny apartment. He encounters the devil, who has made him an exquisite cup of coffee to nurse him through the hangover, while he tells him what the devil tells him what he needs to do. And it's just fun. It's laugh out loud funny. If you like Christopher Moore, this is for you.
Great. Weirdness, Jeremy Bushnell. Ken Sanders.
Doug, as you know.
It's always appropriate for us to end on a poem, right?
Why not? Mm-hmm. I always think so, of course.
Right.
Doug, as you know, David Lee was Utah's first poet laureate and unofficial the pig poet of Paraguna, Utah, from his first collection of poems, The Porcine Canticles. Dave's got a new book out, did a reading a while back at the store called Last Call. It's apologies in advance to David Lee for attempting to read one of his poems, because you got to hear Dave read it. It's written in kind of a southern Utah patois vernacular that's very difficult to achieve. Kay Stokes' First Visitation. I'll buy that sculpture from you. It's not for sale, but you deem it a sculpture. Everything's for sale, and yes, I do. Not everything. You can about name your price. I won't sell it, but I also can't sell it. It's not mine. Whose is it? My son made it. I suppose he owns it. Or my wife. Or even my daddy, the original provider. Maybe we all do, or maybe none of us. Maybe it owns itself. What would you do with it? I'd move it over to my place. If you could get it there, it wouldn't fit. It was made to be right here. Maybe I could make it fit. I can hire a way to get it there. Maybe you couldn't make it fit. Then it would be neither useful nor ornamental, about like an erection on a mule. They say you got away with words. The great arbitrator of all knowledge, opinion, and attitude in the known world extending to the Texas borders. Pretty much. Some say further than that. You can't tell me you couldn't use the money, even if you are a retired professor and all. No, I can't tell you that. But you won't sell it. Why do you want it so much? When you first noticed it, you were quoted as saying it was the ugliest thing you'd ever seen. Changed my mind. Why? Isn't that a rarity? 'Cause there ain't another one around. I'd just like it for it to belong to me. I'd just like to say it was mine. Like about everything else in Garza County. Pretty much.
Say the name of
the plover.
Last Call by David Lee.
Last Call. Okay, so I'm going to get in trouble for doing this, but quickly, just go through a couple. Just say titles.
Okay, titles. Donna Leone, By Its Cover, A Venetian Mystery. The Black-Eyed Blonde, Benjamin Black, A Noir Mystery.
Capital in the 21st Century, Thomas Piketty, Third Plate by Dan Barber, Field Notes on the Future of Food.
Wild Rides and Wild Flowers, Philosophy and Botany with Bikes by Scott Abbott and Sam Rushforth, Bill McKibben, Oil and Money, The Education of an Unlikely Activist.
Wow, that was a lightning round. Good job, guys. We still didn't get to all of them. I should mention, for a complete list, we'll have it on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. Ken Sanders of Ken Sanders Rare Books, Catherine Weller from Weller Bookworks at Trolley Square, Betsy Burton from the King's English Bookshop. Thank you all very, very much.
Thank you.
Radio
Thanks.
West, production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.